Blog Talk Radio.
Home of the stars, through the airwaves and on the big screen. Coming to you live from Hollywood, it's Rated G Radio with your host, Garrett Miller.
Hey everybody, welcome to the show. We're going to have celebrated author, best-selling author, and all-around super-duper great guy, Kurgan Edward Stout, on the show in just a couple of minutes. But for everybody who is listening from around the country, number one, this weather we're having in Southern California the last couple of days is making me very empathetic to people who suffer through snowstorms and sleet and hail and rain all of the time. The mere preponderance of a rain cloud here in California just sends everybody into a tailspin, and we start driving much slower, and then when it actually starts raining, it is a catastrophe on major levels. So if you're in Southern California tonight, thank you for being a great driver. Thank you for being very cognizant of the people that are around you who are also sharing the roadways with you. But today I had a chance to come back from a lunch up in Hollywood with Luis Nariño. He is lead singer of the band Noble Creatures, who was recently on the show. And, you know, I thought, I'm hitting the road. I'm going to be back, you know, on the highway in plenty of time. And it was insane. And I didn't even hit rush hour. So it was crazy for, you know, just afternoon traffic. So if you're out there driving tonight, be safe. But without further ado, Kurgan Edward Stout returns to the show. Kurgan, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm excited that you're here.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for having me back.
You have an open door anytime you want, number one. But you are one of the most requested and most popular guests that we have on the show. So I'm grateful that you're taking time out of your evening tonight to spend an hour with us or however long we want to sit and chit-chat for the evening. But you are really here tonight to talk about World AIDS Day, which was on Monday, December 1st. And I want you to cover everything from A to Z, why it's important, what we need to know, where we've come from, where we're going, and then also talk about the article that you've written for the Huffington Post, AIDS at 32, For Whom the Bell Tolls, 32 Notables Share Their Stories. You have a great write-up on the Huffington Post, as you always do. So anyhow, so thanks for taking time out of your night.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure.
Sure.
It's so nice to have a chance to talk about HIV and AIDS, just because I feel like my issue is that rarely do we, in a way that really matters. Oftentimes, we're talking about debates over, you know, current drug protocols with PrEP and things like that, or it gets into the political, and my view on it really comes from the personal. I came of age during the AIDS crisis, and living through that and being a caregiver to my partner Shane, who died, as well as watching other friends die, really fundamentally shaped me as a person. And so for me, it's a personal endeavor to shed some light on World AIDS Day and the lives of those that we lost.
So I think, you know, anybody who is in the LGBTQ community know somebody who has either passed away from HIV/AIDS or, you know, has been directly affected in it in some capacity. But for people who are outside of, I would say, in the major metropolitan areas or places where it gets a lot of press and a lot of talk in the media, what has World AIDS Day meant to you, and why is this important for people to recognize December 1st for taking note of this?
Well, I think for me personally, it really comes down to something that happened, an interaction that my partner Shane and I had, and this was some time before he actually died. And I think we were sitting in bed and just kind of reading, closing out the night, and he just kind of looked at me and said, "Will you remember me?" And I looked back at him and I said, "Well, of course I'll remember you." And I'm thinking, "Well, what do you know? How could I forget you?" And then he looked at me and he held my hand and he just said, "You know, I want to be remembered." And I think there's something so fundamental about that desire within each of us, regardless of the life that we're living, that when we leave this world, we want to feel like a part of us is continuing. And I had an interesting experience on Monday, which is World AIDS Day, which is I thought of a guy I hadn't thought of in years. And, you know, he wasn't necessarily a great friend of mine, but he was a executive with Walt Disney, and he, for whatever reason, took a liking to me, and he put me on the Disney movie, free movie list. So anytime there was a new Disney movie opening, I would get free passes, which, as a struggling young man in Hollywood in those days, you know, when you have no money, getting free passes for movies meant a great deal. And he actually, his name was Gary Kalkin, and he invited me to probably the best night of my life, hands down. I had tickets one night to this revival of the Broadway show Company with the original cast. 20 years later, they were gathering to do a one-night-only version of the show. And so I had tickets to go see it, and that's my favorite Sondheim show ever. And so I was so excited that this friend and I were going to go see it. And Gary called me, and he said, hey, you know, we've got tickets for a after party for the Golden Globes. Would you like to come? And I said, well, Gary, you know, I'd love to. Unfortunately, I've got these other tickets. And long story short, he said, just, you know, come as quickly as you can and just come for whatever of the party you can. So this friend and I had this amazing night of theater. We rush back to Beverly Hills, and we walk up the red carpet, and photographers are looking at us like, who are you people? You're nobodies. And we get up to the check-in desk, and they're like, well, the party's pretty much over, but if you want, you know, you can go back in and grab a drink. And so my friend and I walked back in, and there were probably 12 to 15 people in the room. And among the people there were Anthony Hopkins, Emma Thompson, Al Pacino, Rodney Dangerfield, and this friend of mine, Gary Kalkin. And just to be standing at the hors d'oeuvres table next to Al Pacino was such a thrill. And, you know, that whole evening was so impactful on me and just my, you know, probably one of the highlights of my life. And, you know, to think that here several years later, I'd almost even forgotten Gary. You know, he is not somebody who I think of often. And all of a sudden, World AIDS Day, he popped into my head. And I thought,
wow.
To me, that's what the day is all about. It's not about bickering. It's not about blame. It's not about, you know, being angry with the powers that be that used to be in control for making this such a scourge on our country and on the LGBTQ community. But it's about remembering, you know, the faces of those that we lost. And so that's its personal relevance for me.
I love the story that you told about Gary. Can you tell us about Shane and how you met, and maybe just a little bit of history about your relationship and what he was all about?
Sure. I mean, I think for me, more than anything, that relationship forever altered me at my core. Prior to meeting Shane, I had been on this journey where I set out thinking I wanted to be an actor, and I had all of the stereotypical conceited actor traits of being self-absorbed and focused on me and my career and what can I get and where do I want to be. And it was about connections and name dropping and all of those kinds of things that now I look back and I think, oh my God, I don't even recognize that person. But that was very much me and my life. And I kind of had a coldness to me and an aloofness that, you know, prevented other people from getting close. And I realized that this was a defect in me. And I had a therapist trying to figure out, you know, what was going on. And she said, you know, I really think you need to get out of your head and do some volunteer work and, you know, stop focusing on yourself so much. And so I started volunteering for AIDS Project Los Angeles, and I volunteered there for a couple of years in the education department, and I went on to become a full-time staff member there, and I ran an education program which was teaching HIV-negative men to stay negative, and everything from, you know, safer sex techniques to self-esteem issues and intimacy. And it really allowed me to use my skills in a way that I wasn't really utilizing them in entertainment. And, you know, for years I would travel and go to some of the Pride festivals, and I would be the guy you'd see pulling somebody out of the crowd and showing how to put a, you know, putting a strap on dildo on them and showing them how to roll a condom on it with my mouth. You know, so it was kind of like I was using my actor skills and kind of in a fun way. And so while I was working at AIDS Project Los Angeles, there was this guy who worked the Southern California AIDS hotline, which was kind of a, if you had any kind of question about HIV or AIDS, you would call this 800 number. And he coordinated all of the volunteers, and this was Shane Sawick. And Shane, he reminds, when I think of him, I think of kind of a young Cary Grant type, except he was a very urbane and very funny and sometimes a little cynical, very, very smart. But he loved to wear overalls and T-shirts, which totally went against the whole Cary Grant thing. But I have seen him trading quips with Rosalind Russell in movies, and he was just very dapper. And yet, at the same time, there was something a little kind of geeky about him. And he told a common friend that he was interested in me, and I thought, okay. I knew he had, at that point, I knew he had a technical AIDS diagnosis. He had T-cells of less than 200. And hadn't had any major opportunistic infections, but technically he had AIDS. And I thought long and hard about whether I, as a HIV-negative man, wanted to open myself up to a relationship with somebody who had AIDS. And I had dated HIV-positive people in the past, and it was not any kind of issue with me. Never had any fears, but I think what concerned me the most was not so much knowing that, any concerns around transmission. It was much more about, okay, this was the days before we had any kind of cocktail therapies and before some of the advances in the drugs that we have today, and knowing that it was essentially a death sentence. And I thought, you know, can I put myself through this? Can I open myself up to the degree emotionally that I need to do to be in a loving relationship with this person? And I was very scared of what it meant for me personally and of course what it meant for him. And ultimately I decided, you know, love only comes along so often, and you need to grab it when you see it and kind of ignore the rest. And so through that process, we were together for 2 years, and he gave me so many firsts in terms of we went to Europe and spent 5 weeks there. And I had never been before, so, you know, to be able to travel to Europe for 5 weeks was such a...
That's amazing.
You know, amazing gift to me, and just the people he introduced me to and the experiences we had really made an impact on me. And then, of course, when he did get sick, he got a disease called progressive multifocal leukoencephalopathy, which is PML for short, which I'll call it PML because I can barely say the other. But essentially, it's a lesion on the brain that starts to affect the motor skills. And so slowly, even though he was totally alert inside his head, he started to lose some of his functions. We would be driving in the car, and he would either slow down too soon or he would stop a little too quickly. And he just, you could tell he was a little impaired, and he would be walking, and all of a sudden he would kind of take a step in the wrong direction, and it quickly snowballed. And essentially, we were trying to keep him at home as much as possible, but it got to the point where he couldn't speak and he couldn't communicate except by blinking his eyes. And
oh my gosh!
We put him in the hospital on my 30th birthday, and he was dead within 2 weeks.
Oh, my gosh.
So, you know, it was a horrible time for so many people. And, you know, for me, it was horrible. And yet when I think about the gift I received as a result of that experience, the person I am now is fundamentally different than who I was then. I opened myself up. You know, I think for me, so many of my initial issues in terms of being self-centered and holding people off is, you know, I didn't really know what my emotions held. I didn't know what the depths of me held and what I was, you know, there were things I was afraid of. I was afraid of going to a certain emotional level, and I was afraid of loss and what I would do. And I think, really, I was afraid that if I started crying or allowed myself to show any kind of emotion, I would never stop. And so there was this big fear of emotion that surrounded me. And so being able to love Shane and, you know, the experiences I had with him and having that cherished role of being his caregiver really opened me up as a human being. And at his memorial service, I was able to grieve in front of people openly, which I would have never thought I would have been able to do. And I think that's that evolution of my being is a direct result of him. And I don't think I would be an effective writer or a very good partner or a good father today that I think I am, you know, without having had that amazing relationship. So I really look at that as a pivotal time for me. And I think that's one of the reasons that World AIDS Day is important, because I don't know about you, but in the circles I travel in, most often, at least the gay men that I speak with, are not really interested in having a conversation around loss or the people that we lost or anything to do with it. And I think there's a lot of reasons for that. But,
let me ask you,
important
then,
to
what
have
do you
that
think,
conversation.
What do you think some of the reasons are?
Well, I think, you know, there are a variety of reasons. I think, of course, most people don't like reflecting on negative experiences. Most people don't like visiting hospitals or thinking about the politics involved in HIV and AIDS. But I think for LGBTQ people, there's perhaps another issue, and I don't know that this is accurate or not, but my sense is we are told from the time we're little that there's something wrong with us, that we are sick, that we have an illness. And even though we may know that not to be true internally, I think, you know, we still hear that enough, and there's a part of us that always kind of, there's a question mark that lingers unless you can work through that. And all of a sudden we were faced with an actual disease that other people, again, told us, this is your punishment, this is your, this is because you are a deviant person that we're putting this on to you, or God has put this on to you. And so it brings us back to a place of shame. And I think for so many of us, we've worked to walk out of the place of shame and walk into a place where we hold our heads up high and feel good and whole. And I think AIDS somehow puts that question mark back into our heads of, are we really whole? Are we really, you know, the people that we think we are and that we know ourselves to be internally, but society has told us again and again, you know, you're not worthy. And I think it's just a kind of a reminder of that negativity that so many of us have struggled with.
So let me ask you this. So, you know, we are men of a certain age, meaning that, you know, we're not 21 any longer.
I'm closing in on 50, proudly.
So, you know, it's at least for me, I know when the AIDS crisis started, and I was, you know, in high school, I had no concept about any of this stuff or, you know, what it was impacting, what it was doing. And it was just one of those things that it's like, well, I don't know anybody that has AIDS. I don't know anybody who has HIV. It wasn't something that ever really connected or hit home with me until I moved down to Arizona State. And where I worked with a couple of people that ended up having HIV and AIDS and ultimately passed away. And that was my first indoctrination to know anybody that, you know, was affected by it. And if I knew people before that had it, I certainly wasn't aware of it. And it was very, very shocking. And so, you know, I think we have a different perspective at this particular point in our lives about what it's done to the community, what it's done to people. And then you go and meet, you know, younger people, and you talk to them about HIV and AIDS, and it's almost like an afterthought a lot of times to them. It's like, oh, that's, you know, this is something you're just going to take a pill for if you get it. And what is your sense of, society or, you know, the different generational thoughts about HIV and AIDS?
Well, I think you're definitely right in terms of, I think there is a generational aspect to it. What was encouraging to me about, you mentioned the article in Huffington Post called AIDS at 32, which I wrote, I put together last, I believe it was September, but it essentially was looking at the 32nd anniversary of HIV/AIDS being mentioned in the New York Times, which was the first kind of publication to recognize and talked about this gay cancer that was affecting people. And what was interesting to me about that is, in writing this piece, I spoke to 32 different people, some celebrities, some not, some who were people who were activists in the trenches during the AIDS crisis, some people were younger and hadn't really directly experienced the crisis, but I asked each of them, how has HIV and AIDS impacted your life on a personal level? And, you know, from some people like actress Judith Light, she was very much about how it informed her activism. Things like that were to be expected, or, people paying tribute to those that they'd lost. And so for some of the older people, it was much more about, yes, this happened, and kind of a recognition. And what I was very happy to see is that some of the younger people, you know, we tend to hear, oh, young people don't know anything about HIV and AIDS, or mm-hmm. they don't really care about the epidemic. And that may, by and large, be true. But one person I interviewed was James Duke Mason, who's actually, he's very young. He is an actor. His mom is Belinda Carlisle of the Go-Go's. And he impressed me because here he was quoting, the author Paul Manette, who is not only a writer but a poet, and wrote very movingly about his experiences with HIV and AIDS. And he mentioned Larry Kramer, who really spearheaded ACT UP, and a lot of the advances that we have today are a result of that organization. And so here was this young person who I wouldn't have thought would have even known much, and yet here he was able to, pay tribute to these people and the debt that was paid on his behalf, and enabling him to have this life now where HIV is happily, a manageable disease. Although, people still do die. I had a friend die about a year and a half ago, and, people become resistant to drugs and other things happen. So, unfortunately, while we call it manageable, it's not entirely manageable, and still, there are concerns around younger people and the risks that they're willing to take when, if all that they have to do is take a pill, what does that do to you, and what place does that put you in? And does that put you in a safer place, or does that put you in a place where you're open to increased risk?
So, that is something that I just still can't wrap my head around very well, is the fact that, so many kids today say, well, I'll just take a pill for it. It's like not a big deal. Or, they think of it as like an old person's disease, which is interesting at this point, just simply because it impacts everybody across every socioeconomic background, ethnicity, you name it. It's something that it strikes everywhere. And to say, to hear them say, I'll just take a pill, I just don't resonate with that at all.
No. I don't know. Something I don't understand, and I wish people would take more caution around, but, I remember being young too and having that inevitable, that thought that I can do anything I want,
yeah.
And, I'm going to live forever. So I understand that way of thinking too.
Well, I want to ask more about other things that are going on in your life, including your books and what's happening at home and holidays. So before we kind of shift gears here, is there anything else that the listeners should know about either your article or World AIDS Day or anything else on this topic?
Well, just a couple points. I think right now LGBTQ Nation has shared an article I wrote for them 2 years ago on World AIDS Day. It's up on their homepage. And it kind of talks about Shane a little bit and the importance of remembering. And in that vein, one of the things that I think is interesting, if people were to look into it, is to really look into the names of those who have died. Somebody brought to my attention that Isaac Asimov, who's a very famous science fiction writer, one of the best-selling novelists of his time, actually contracted HIV as a result of a blood transfusion and died of that. And yet his family kept it hidden for many years. because of the fear of reprisals in terms of, you know, people buying his books, because there was such a stigma. And he
really
was one of the most well-known. Yes. You know, so there's stories like that that I wish people knew. You know, Arthur Ashe, who was a famous tennis legend and straight man, died of HIV and AIDS. And, you know, of course, we have the more well-known examples like Rock Hudson. But, you know, we lost so many amazingly talented people. And I wish people would just take the time to, you know, when they see a story about somebody dying of AIDS, just read it and think about that person and you know, kind of lift up the people that we lost, because I think there's something very empowering about acknowledging that. You know, in my day-to-day life, as I mentioned to you earlier, I've been at places where with other gay men, regardless of age, and, you know, somebody brings up HIV or AIDS, and everyone just kind of, like, stops talking and looks at each other, and then they say, but about Lady Gaga or Madonna?
Right.
Something fun and frivolous. And, you know, they're not willing to go to a deeply emotional place. And I hope we as a community continue to evolve and try to embrace that time for the good things that came out of it in terms of our strength as a community and the impact that we made, you know, battling a disease virtually on our own. And I also hope that gay men start to appreciate the role that lesbians played in that battle, because right now I feel like there's a little bit of a sexism, you know, divide in gays and lesbians, and yet so many women stepped up during that time to help their brothers, and I think, you know, there's several debts that need to be repaid.
Can I go back real quick, and you talked about making sure to remember people that we've lost to this. I didn't know about Isaac Asimov, so this is just a big lightning bolt for me. Who tells their stories?
Well, I think that's the whole point, is that most people don't tell these stories, and I think, you know, when you hear about somebody like Nureyev, you know, the most famous dancer of his time, and the fact that that life was snuffed out, and we won't have any more of his dances. You know, that's an important fact that people need to remember. And unfortunately, because generationally so many kind of people who would have been middle age are gone, we don't have those storytellers. You know, we have older people who lived through it, and they are now either, you know, tired of talking about it, or they are in ill health. You know, the stories are getting lost. And so that's part of what I did, you know, when I wrote, I was inspired by Shane to write my first book, and I had never really given much thought to being a novelist, or I'd been writing screenplays and things like that in my entertainment work, but one day a line just popped into my head, and I didn't really know who it was or what it was or what it was going to lead to, but I wrote it down, and that line became the first line in my novel, which is called Songs for the New Depression, and it was really inspired by Shane, and it's the narrator is, it's not necessarily Shane, it's a very fictionalized version of him, because it's much more cynical and caustic than Shane ever was, but it really tries to tell the story of somebody who is facing the end of their life, realizing that they've made mistakes, and just like Shane, this character is facing death and is unable to communicate, and yet knows he made horrible, horrible mistakes in his life and wants to make amends, but is unable physically to do so. So it's kind of about that struggle, and it walks you back through his life and what happened to him. And my entire point in writing that book was really to try to capture one person's story that was somebody battling AIDS, and, you know, hopefully when people read it, they will think, okay, I understand what this was about. I understand what the struggle was about. I understand what it's like to face a illness like that. And, you know, it was a huge motivating factor in writing the book. And, you know, happily when people read it, the response I'm getting is, you know, they do get it and they do remember. And whether it's Shane's story or someone else's, I think just we as a community need to tell the stories of those we've loved and those we've lost.
I completely agree. And you have another book that you've talked about on our show before, but since it's the holiday season, now seems to be a fantastic time to remind people about it. This is your second book called Gifts Not Yet Given. By the way, if you're listening to the show tonight, number one, thank you. And number two, both of these books are available on Amazon, but just simply by clicking the little show link that is on the computer screen that you're looking at right now. So if you want to go buy the book, I always say anytime we have a guest on, go support the cause. You know, go click and make the purchase, whether it's a book or an album or whatever the case is. But tell us a little bit about Gifts Not Yet Given. And this has been a huge big darn deal for you. You've won awards. You've sent, if I say millions and millions and millions of copies, that might be a little bit of a stretch, but it sold very, very well. What are people telling you about it?
Well, you know, I think, you know, similarly to what we were talking about with my first book, a little bit of Shane lives on in this, and that I was inspired to write this. This is a collection of short stories that all kind of revolve around holidays. And Shane was a huge Christmas fanatic. And one of the things he left to me was this Nutcracker collection, which his mom had started for him. And on any important occasion, whether it was a birthday or graduation or Christmas, she would give him a Nutcracker as kind of their, you know, bond, a sign of their bond. And so he had this collection that he bequested to me, and I think there were maybe 30, something like that. And so after he died, I decided to continue that collection with my kids. I've got two boys, and who are now 12 and almost 15. And so every Christmas Eve, I continue that tradition by giving them each a Nutcracker. And so we've got more Nutcrackers than I know what to do with. And my partner Russ is always like, wait a second, we've got to stop. But I think we've probably got 80.
Kurgan, here's the most important question of the night. At this stage of the game, where do you buy Nutcrackers that you haven't already bought?
You know, you would be amazed at how many different Nutcrackers there are.
Really?
There are Nutcrackers in, you know, think of it like any other tchotchke out there. If somebody can make a buck, they will make a buck. So there are, I'm sitting here in our, to get some privacy in this house of ours, I'm sitting in our guest bedroom right now staring at three different Nutcrackers, all from Tchaikovsky's famous ballet. And one is the Mouse King, one is the little girl whose name I'm blanking on, who has the dream, and the other one is the gentleman who brings the Nutcracker. The Drosselmeyer, I think his name is. So I'm sitting at three, you know, looking at three distinct Nutcrackers, all very different, and that's just a fraction of the ones out there. I've seen a Moses Nutcracker. I've seen, you know, a ballerina Nutcracker, just everything under the sun. So there are a wide variety. But my whole point in this story was, you mentioned the book, and the very first story in the book, Gifts Not Yet Given, is called The Nutcracker, and that was kind of intentional on my part. It was just to give Shane a little nod. But each story in the book is really about a person, a different kind of person, facing some kind of pivotal moment in their life where they make a choice. And that choice may be positive or negative, but my belief is that we are really defined by our actions and not what we say about ourselves, but really what we do. And so each one of these people faces a moment of enlightenment where they make a choice only to discover whether that was the right choice or the wrong choice. And so it's really about personal growth. And my goal with this was to not only, you know, tell tales of the holidays and personal enlightenment, but several of the characters are LGBTQ, because growing up, being a Christmas fanatic myself, just like Shane, you know, I never saw in any of the things that I would read or watch gay characters in Christmas things. It just didn't exist. It was like these
gay people don't celebrate
Christmas.
Yeah,
exactly. And, you know, they were all, you know, very straight, traditional, kind of by the book fairy tales. And I really wanted to put a little reality into it. And so some of the tales are about Christmas, some are about other holidays, like Valentine's Day and Easter Bunny, and they're all about different kinds of people experiencing something unique and memorable in their lives. And so it was really my attempt to shed some light on some areas we typically don't see in holiday tales, and also, you know, give a nod to Shane. And you know, like I mentioned, for me, it's all about moving forward as a human being. So hopefully that book will help people do just that.
So everybody needs to go out and buy Gifts Not Yet Given and Songs for the New Depression, the two books that are out right now by Kurgan Edward Stout, our celebrated author tonight. Are you working on any new material right now?
I am. You know, it's funny that you mentioned that. I have a memoir that, well, two things. Number one, I've got an article that's going to be in Huffington Post in the next several weeks that's really about my wedding to my partner, Russ, and the importance of marriage equality. So that will be running very soon. We're just waiting for a video of our wedding to be completed, to be included in that. So that's one thing. That's the most immediate thing. But the second thing, it's kind of interesting that you asked that, because just today I was going back to a memoir that I started some time ago, and it's about a very tricky relationship that I had that came just after Shane. And the book is called Never Turn Your Back on the Tide, and it really is about what happened to me post-Shane. You know, I think after Shane's death, I thought, okay, I've been challenged emotionally, I've been challenged physically, I'm exhausted, I have had a very difficult experience, and so now good things are going to come, because, you know, I grew up believing, you know, God watches over the good people, and karma, you know, good things will come to those who do good, and obviously if you don't do good, you know, bad things will come. And I kind of bought into a lot of those nice ideas, but thinking that perhaps they were true. And my first major relationship after Shane was with a gentleman who I ended up adopting my eldest son with, Mason. And when we'd been together about 6 years, well, probably about five when Mason came along. So Mason was a year and a half old, and all of a sudden, one day I discovered that this person who I had chosen as my partner was basically a psychopath and had created an entire fictional life. And it was really about, you know, discovering that everything you think you know and hold to be true suddenly is proved to be false. I kind of tell people jokingly, it's like those Lifetime movies they used to run all the time.
Right.
Valerie Bertinelli would be this innocent stay-at-home mom, and she'd be raising her kids, and she'd be living in the Midwest somewhere, and her husband would be this dashing airplane pilot. And later in the movie, you find out that he's got Susan Lucci and her kids on the East Coast, and, you know, I don't know who playing, you know, the other woman on the West Coast with their life. And I basically found out he had two other long-term relationships going on at the same time we were together.
Wow.
And none of us knew about the other people. And it was really startling and eye-opening. And I think, you know, I think probably what was going on in my head was, I think I lulled myself into buying into those fantasies that I mentioned and thinking, okay, you're a good person, you went through this terrible ordeal, and now good things are going to happen to you.
Mm-hmm.
So even though there were warning signs that I probably should have paid more attention to, I bought his story hook, line, and sinker, because I really did believe that, you know, good things were going to be on my, you know, radar. And so I'm writing a memoir about that. But it's really, you know, telling a story like that is very challenging, because this person is, my ex is still in my life, and my son sees him regularly. And so, you know, there's, you know, I want to be cautious of that. And also I want to tell the story respectfully and truthfully, but also, you know, in a way that is entertaining and doesn't seem like a Lifetime TV movie of the week that, you know, makes people, I don't want people to just go, oh, this poor guy. You know, I want to tell
them
in a way that ultimately, you know, you can face anything and walk away from it. So I've been working with that and playing with that. And what's interesting is that as I've returned to it recently, There's so much humor in it, which I didn't feel or acknowledge at the time. But looking back on it, I can laugh about some of these things that are just absolutely crazy. One day, my ex shaved his head, and I had
what?
No inkling. He just showed up with a shaved head, and you know, I
what, how do you react to that?
Not. Well, I'm just looking at him, and I'm like, why would you do this? And he just said, well, I've always wanted to. And I'm thinking, well, you've never mentioned that in the 6 years we've been together. But, you know, what turned out to be the truth was he actually told certain people in his life, in these other worlds, that he had cancer, and he was going through chemotherapy. So he actually shaved his head to make him believe
that
he was going
through
chemo.
That is so not funny, Kurgan. But...
it's not. Well, it is now, you know.
Well,
it
is now.
When I found out the truth about what was going on with him, I just thought, oh my God, this person, you know, is clearly unstable and very creative
in
storytelling. But, you know, I thought it was the worst thing ever. And now I look back at it and go, okay, this is, now it's funny. You know, many years later, now it's funny. And so
right.
I want to be able to tell this story in a way that's not depressing and, you know, bring some humor to the situation. And so I'm hoping to finish that out in the next year and get that published as soon as I can.
Very good. Well, real quick, can we talk about the family? What's going on with the boys? I keep seeing pictures of Mason in his football jersey winning awards and all kinds of stuff like that. What are the boys up to?
Well, I've got, as you know, two boys. Mason is our oldest. He is 14. He's going to be 15 next month. And he is just loving being a freshman in high school. He is eating this up. It's always been his dream to play football, and we let him play for a couple of seasons in what they call kind of their version of Pop Warner. And
okay.
We had some grade issues where his grades suffered, and so we pulled him, and so he really was dying to play this year. And we agreed to let him play, and so his team, which had not been to the playoffs in something like 15 years at least, went on to become league champs. And he was awarded the best defensive player of the year by his teammates. His teammates voted him that. And I just, you know, I started crying at the awards banquet because the coach got up and was announcing the award. And he talked about with Mason how, you know, there are some kids that give him hope. And Mason was one of those kids. And
oh,
it's just
man.
Apparent, you know, you hear that and you – I focus typically on the day-to-day. I take the kids to their appointments. I run them to school. We check their homework. I have no idea if I'm being a good dad or not. Sometimes, you know, we have those bad moments where you're just like, I fucked up so badly. That was a bad parenting move. And then other times you're going, well, maybe I'm getting this right. And then, you know, you hear somebody else say something like that, and you just go, okay, so I may not be the best parent in the world, but at least, you know, this kid is going to be okay. On some level, he's going to be okay. And the fact that his teammates, you know, appreciate him and his coach does as well, that meant a lot. So that was a thrill. And then Marcus. Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, it's, you know, because with both of your kids, you know, and you were like this too when you were growing up, and so was I. You know, you have the, you know, persona that you bring home as the child of the house. But, you know, when you leave and you go to school and you're interacting with your friends and your teachers and everything else, you have a completely different person that the parent never sees. And so having the coach get up there and talk about Mark Mason like that and the other players voting him in defensive player of the year and that type of thing. I think I would have been right there with you, just bawling my eyes out because you just don't, I mean, it's like, that's not the kid that I see. You know, it might be a great kid that comes home, but that's not the kid that you see because it's that person growing up into a fine young man.
Exactly. And, you know, I think like most people, you know, I have my own doubts about myself and my abilities. And so to have something positive like that happen really was important for
you're
me.
You're doing good. You and Russ are doing good.
Well, thank you. Yeah, and our youngest, Marcus, I'm going to be curious to see where he ends up in life. He's a handful on a good day, but he brings us such joy, and he constantly making us laugh, and you know, I feel like he's going to be kind of the next Chris Rock or something. I mean,
really?
I see his age, you know, making people laugh. He's just constantly cracking jokes and telling stories and adopting these bizarre characters he just comes up with, and he'll just start talking in a voice, and so he's really just keeps us in stitches. So I'm very curious about the path he'll be traveling.
What are you guys going to do for the holidays?
You know, we are going to be hanging here in Orange County, which is where we live, and we've got family coming over for the holidays, and we typically do, you know, some family celebrations, and we used to throw a annual Christmas party, which the last one happened 2 years ago, and it was huge. It was first of all, we do three trees. We have this very ornate tree that I kind of manage, which has ornaments through the years and everything from toenail clippers from the Eiffel Tower to, you know, very expensive ornaments to, yeah, I've got like a little license plate which has Mason's name on it. Just very random, and yet you put them together in this beautiful tree. So we've got one big tree. We've got another typically live tree that has more of a rustic theme. We put a small tree in the kids' room, which has their kind of like their handmade things and superhero ornaments. And so we go all out at Christmas, and we typically throw these big parties where I cook all the food and make all the desserts and all this kind of stuff. And 2 years ago, we had about 150 people at our house.
Oh, my gosh.
It was packed, and it was a kid, you know, it was a family get-together. We had,
sure,
obviously, gay, straight, a mix of ages. Well, someone, and I'm not saying who, took somebody in the backyard, and this woman, I guess, smoked pot. And
oh, no.
She'd been drinking.
Oh.
And so somehow, in her way back from the backyard into the house, she passed out. And luckily we had a doctor here who started attending to her, and she woke up, and then she passed out again, and so paramedics were called. So we've got this huge Christmas party going on. Paramedics stroll in. Some half of the crowd thinks they're, you know, possibly male strippers just in uniform, and that they're going to get a show. And it was this turned what was a beautiful, lovely party into an awful experience where Russ is just like, we cannot do this again.
We're done.
We have not done a big party, and you know, part of me regrets not doing a big party, but we're going to keep it kind of simple this year because we just the pain still kind of lingers from that experience.
Yeah. Well, you guys have had a big year in so many different ways. You guys got married. You've had camping trips. You've done, I mean, every time I check up on you on Facebook, something else is big in your life. So it's always fun to kind of catch up with you there. So I'm thrilled that you came back on tonight. Before I let you go, do you want to give any special shout-outs to folks along the way?
You know, first of all, I'd just like to thank your listeners. It's a pleasure to talk to you, as always, Garrett. I enjoy, you know, what you bring to the community and just having a platform to let people talk about their different views is an exciting thing, and I appreciate what you do.
Oh, you're well. I love having you on. So our Mutual Admiration Society is now in session. So I'm going to bang the gavel.
Well, thanks.
Okay.
Thanks, and you know, I appreciate you, and of course, your listeners and their support, and just, you know, since this is all about the season for giving thanks and celebrating friends and family, just, you know, we just like to shout out to my friends and family for the support they give me, because just getting through life sometimes can be a struggle. And I think, you know, having the support of loved ones around you to kind of pick you up when you fall down and gently lift you up and hold you as you move forward is such a blessing. And I don't take it for granted. So I'm appreciative of every day, and kind of going back to the whole World AIDS Day, I'm appreciative of having Shane and seeing, you know, the impact that he had on me. And I just hope, as your listeners, you know, go about their daily lives, if they hear about stories of people facing AIDS, that they just pay a little attention, because there are so many voices out there of people who want to be remembered just like Shane and may not have the platform that I've been able to give him.
Very well said. everybody, you need to go out and check out Kurgan's article on Huffington Post. It's, again, the link's on. I make it easy for you guys now. Click on the link that's on the show page. Go buy his two books that he's got out there. And let's get you back in January. We'll find something fun to talk about and go from there.
Great. Thank you so much.
Cool. Thanks, Kurgan. Say hi to everybody for me. And this is a little Joseph Eid, his song Human. And we'll be back with a wrap-up in just a second. Hang on, everybody.
We will find a way to kill our desires. We will find a way to keep getting higher. We will find a way to live like they say in the books with all the saints. We will do our best to pass every test. We'll deny ourselves of all good sex. And one day our bodies will freeze and our hearts will go numb. Don't that sound fun? Flesh and blood, I'm human. Ain't it good to be human? I wanna live like one here on earth with no heaven, no hell. And when I die, I got enough time to be an angel. Young, I heard of Judgment Day, when God will come down and my sins will be weighed. They painted a picture of hate, and I learned how to pray, 'cause I was afraid to be flesh and blood and human. Here on earth with no heaven nor hell. And when I die, yeah, I got enough time to be an angel. To be an angel. A monk or a saint. I just wanna run free on my bare feet, play under the sun and swim in the sea, and take you off to that moonlit tree. We'll bite from that apple 'cause it tastes so
go. That's little Joseph Eads off of his album Human. That's the title track, Human. Big thanks again to Kurgan Edward Stout for coming on the show tonight to talk about AIDS at 32. He's got a great article on the Huffington Post right now. You can click the link on the show to read that. The 32 stars that he has on there each give a little testimony or story about how AIDS has impacted their lives. And I think that's important to read. You can take a look at some of the people that he has gotten to interview for the article there. Please go check that out and go buy his books. We have two really cool shows for the rest of the week. Tomorrow night is Thursday night, and we're going to have Dr. Annie Ulrich back to talk about December's energy. And she will also talk dream interpretation. So if you want to come in and talk to her about any of the fun stuff that she's involved with, please do so. She may even have a holiday gift to give out to listeners tomorrow as well. So there's a little sneak for you. And then Friday we've got Liz DeRoche, and she's going to come on and talk about her Singing Lizards children music that she has in store for us. Next week and the week after, we've got full slates of programming with fantastic guests, full range of spectrum from everything going on in local community things in Oregon. We've got something happening down in Norco for the, it's called Parade of Lights. We're going to have folks talking about that next week. We've also got a really cool night on Friday night, the 12th. It's actually going to be an afternoon show called Miles High Holiday. We're going to be featuring guests of Miles High Productions and their artists, most of which are going to be calling in. So we're going to be hearing from the artists as well for two full hours and playing their Christmas music. We've got some great stars lined up for that, so I'm really excited for you to be there for that show. But again, the next 2 weeks of programming, the holidays aren't taking a vacation here, but I will be gone the last 2 weeks of the year coming back. After the 19th, I think that's a Friday, I'm going to be taking the last 2 weeks of the year off to regroup and get some really cool things going for January and February. We've got guests that are just chomping at the bit to come on the show, so I can't wait to share that with you, and including some new programming, I would say options, because it's not really an option. I'm kind of like turbocharging the show, so I'm excited to share that with you. But in the meantime, here's one more song from Joseph E. This is called Ready Now, and then I will see you live tomorrow night on Thursday. Don't drive distracted, especially if it's raining in Southern California. Have a great night, and we'll see you tomorrow.
I grew so many little hearts for you, but they died untended. Well, I've been watching you real close lately, been working out at your gym, and I've been talking to all your friends to tell me that you broke up with him.
I think you're ready now, I think you're ready now, I think you're ready to love me. I think you're ready now, I think you're ready now, I think you're ready to love me.
The secret laws of attraction, baby, I made a school out of them. I built my vision boards as high as heaven, I stuck you all over.
been listening to Rated G Radio.